to tonight's meeting. It's Ittings and Branch Socialist Party, and this is a new venue for us, and we hope that it, gets off to a good start. The meeting tonight is called Abolish Money, We'd Be Better Off Without It, and the speaker is Kitten Slapper. He's going to speak for about 25 minutes or so, and then we'll have a quick break and make some announcements, take a collection, and have a discussion period. Hopefully it will be a nice, informal, good discussion with lots of participation. And, aim to finish the meeting by about 10:15 or so, 10:30, so we can go downstairs and, more informal discussion. 10 in the pub downstairs. So, I hope you enjoy it, and it will start.
Thanks very much. I'd like to start by welcoming you all and pointing out how fortunate we are tonight to be out as opposed to in, because of course if we were in and we were tuned into the television or the radio, you would find in all likelihood that you would have a plethora of pompous politicians and assorted professional fools parading their stupidity across the screens and the radio airwaves, commenting in ponderous tones upon today's wonderful budget. Because once a year, it's going to be twice a year this year because they've got one in November as well, because they can't make up their mind when to have it. There is this capitalist celebration of economic nonsense in which supposedly the Chancellor of the Exchequer waves his little briefcase in the air and out pops all of these wonderful surprises and exciting announcements which make absolutely sod all difference to the vast majority of people. We're expected to get very excited about it and to debate about it and to argue about it and to watch television or radio all night tonight if you were in. Luckily or not, and to think about it. And of course, if you look at the kind of things that were announced today, you'll find that the vast majority of them, indeed all of them, will make little or no difference to anyone, actually. No one in the country looking at today's budget announcements who will have their condition of life changed in any substantial way, I would contend, by any of those decisions. Let's take one or two examples whilst we're on it. The 20 pence income tax ban, 20 pence in the pound, has been extended to cover a further £500 of annual income. What that means in practical terms is that those who supposedly benefit from this announcement will benefit to the tune of £25 per annum in an entire year. And to think that there is actually time being taken up on television, on radio, minute after minute, dealing with that fact, and yet the actual net result of it is so minor. For those of you who, indeed the vast majority, who will benefit by £25 a year as a result of that announcement, of course the very same £25 will then be taken away with the other hand in terms of additional costs on drink or petrol or whatever else. They announced that there's going to be VAT charged on future fuel bills from next year. Various other decisions. The recent minor bouts of champagne cork popping, I don't think, which have taken place amongst the wonderful so-called property workers who have mortgages to worry about, because the mortgage interest rate went down slightly, are now told that as a result of changes in mortgage interest relief, again, a large part of that money is going to be taken straight back again. These announcements and decisions are piffling rubbish. They are nonsense. They make no difference at all to anyone. And yet we are spending hours of radio and television time and newspaper columns, inches of newspaper columns, pondering all of these details, and it prompts the question, why? Why do people get so worked up about these very minor changes? There are two points I think to make here. Firstly, the reason that people are fixed to their screens tonight, watching these boring experts talk about the budget, is that they are in such poverty, various degrees of poverty, in the case of the vast majority of the population, that therefore it might make a difference to see a few pennies, and it is literally pennies, taken away here or given to us there. Anyone who can have any concern for that at all must be in an extremely impoverished position. The second reason I contend why people pay any attention to this nonsense once a year is that it's a kind of ritual, a kind of national celebration of the fantasy world of economics. What's being told to us through all of this coverage is that the economy is under the control of the government, that the Chancellor of the Exchequer makes certain key decisions, and that these decisions in turn will somehow affect human history. They will have some importance over the lives of human beings. This, in fact, is a fantasy. The market system of society which we currently live under is out of control and always has been. Any time the government pretends to be able to shape it and mould it and control its course. They are engaging in a very simple and very transparent con trick. They themselves must surely know after all these years that they are hardly able to control the economy. And from time to time, the politicians admit that. From time to time, they admit that they are incapable of making predictions about the ups and downs of the market system of society which we live under. It is a system of society which is unpredictable and uncontrollable and should therefore be scrapped. But instead of scrapping it, we have this kind of ritual where once a year the politicians make a lot of noise, a lot of hot air, and pretend to be in control of things and pretend that they're making decisions which actually count for something. Now, what we're going to be looking at tonight, if you like, is the alternative budget, the only one that counts. And that is the one that abolishes the entire system. It abolishes the money system. It gets rid of the money system, lock, stock and barrel. And that, in fact, is a change we'll be examining later on. And it's the only change worth even talking about, given the kind of social problems which we're facing right now. So I'd like to start by having a slightly closer look at one or two features of the system which exists. Today's economic system, which we all live under, whether we like it or not, it's there, and we're all directly experiencing it right now. And in order to, as it were, take a peephole into this system, I'd like to look at a newspaper from a few days ago. This is like on Play School, where you say, let's look through the round window or the square window. We're actually going to look through the pound sign shape window. And in The Guardian, on the 13th of March, just a few days ago, two or three days ago, there was a very revealing expose, very revealing article. The main subject of which was fairly boring. It was to do with possible changes to tax law. But it had a very revealing aspect to it. And so I read the first part of the article. It said, and I quote, on the first anniversary of John Major's elevation from Chancellor to Prime Minister, nine in the billionaire class who qualify for foreign domicile tax status attended a fundraising dinner in Downing Street. During the evening, the possibility of tax rules for foreigners in Britain being changed was raised. Mr. Major indicated, after a glance at John Maples, the then Treasury Minister, that the government had no intention of changing the rules. The article went on to explain in detail how the rules in question are basically Swiss-type rules which allow foreign investors who have billions to invest, provided they reside in Britain for a certain portion of the year, to enjoy completely tax-free status on their investments in this country. It's a particular loophole enjoyed by some of these billionaires who sat around the table that night, nine billionaires who sat around John Major's table. And the article went on to expose a particular scandal which showed how certain of those nine billionaires and others like them had a curious pattern of making enormous donations to the Conservative Party Central Office funds. I'm talking about donations counted by the million from private individuals. And I would contend that for a private individual to donate more than £1 million to a political party based in a country which is not even their country of origin or residence, these people, A, must have enormous wealth, and B, are clearly thinking of some sort of vested interest when they make such payments. And the article was exposing that scandal. But the phrase that caught my eye in the quotation I've given is where they say, nine in the billionaire class, nine individual human beings who are billionaires sat around that table and talked business. And this is a very interesting starting point, because the capitalist system which exists today throughout the world divides the human species into two very specific human groups or classes. On the one hand, there is a very small minority, probably no more than 1 or 2%, who are able to enjoy comfortable lifestyles from birth till death, and secure lifestyles, without ever being compelled to seek employment from one day of their life to the next. They're billionaires, they may be multimillionaires, even millionaires. They form a very small percentage of the population. They do not have to work. That's not to say that they don't do any work, simply to say they're not compelled to seek work in the way that the rest of us are. They, in fact, own and control all of the productive resources of society. They own all of the factories, farms, land, mines, communications, transport, industry, agriculture, chemical production, medical production, and so on. They own the lot, all of those productive resources which we all depend upon throughout planet Earth. On the other hand, you have the vast majority, at least 95% of the population, who go out to work, or who try to go out to work, who seek work. If they can't find work, they sign on the dole. If they're not signing on the dole, it might be because they are dependent upon a close relative who is seeking work. These are the working class families who form the vast majority of the population. Some may regard themselves as working class. Some may regard themselves with that slight pomposity as being middle class. But the fact is, in technical terms, this vast majority, and I'm sure it includes almost certainly everyone here tonight, these are ordinary people who work for a living, whether it's for a wage or a salary, and who own no resources, no substantial resources, upon which they can fall back in times of difficulty. They therefore have a life of constant worry, insecurity, concern about paying the bills, concern about where the next month's money is coming from, or next year's money is coming from, fear of redundancy, experience from time to time of unemployment, and all that that brings. So you have these two classes throughout the world today. The third key aspect of the system we live under is that all of the goods and services which are produced throughout society and on which we live are in fact produced on the terms of those who control society. The people who own the factories, farms, mines and so on are in a position of power in which they are able quite legally and quite legitimately to dictate to the rest of us if and when they will allow the rest of us to use those productive resources, to use that machinery, to use those factories, to enter those libraries or schools or hospitals. And of course, the terms upon which they allow us to enter those hallowed gates and to start work producing things is not on some sort of whim. They allow us to go get on with the job in hand if and when they feel it will benefit them for us so to do. In other words, when they feel that we can produce goods for them which they can sell on the open market to realise a cash profit. In times of recession or relative recession, where they feel that times are a little more hard and sales are less likely to be forthcoming, there's a very short delay before they instruct their workforce to withdraw and retire from that process. Hence, you have unemployment as a direct result of this process, coming hand in hand with it as sure as night follows day, not just in times of mass unemployment, but all the time as a constant threat, which rears its head from time to time. Finally, those products which we've produced are sold for cash on the market, helping to realise this surplus value or this profit for those who in fact control and own all of production. The way it works quite simply in mathematical terms is that the wages and salaries we as productive people are ultimately paid, and that of course includes things like the dole, which are part of that calculation, the money we receive ultimately will be worth less than the goods and services which we have created. And it's that difference, it's that gap between the wealth that we create and the wealth that we receive in terms of wages. That, in fact, is what is called profit. And it belongs quite legally, as I say, to the very small minority who own and control all of production throughout society. Now, of course, we can describe that system as unjust and unfair, and it would seem somewhat appropriate. We can describe that system as unequal, inequitable, disgusting, sordid, horrible, and many more words, all of which I'm sure are somewhat appropriate. But we in the Socialist Party do not believe that a kind of moral indignation about the unfairness of that system will get us anywhere. Neither will the kind of bitterness or jealousy which such a system is all too likely to create in the vast majority who are simply not being treated fairly. What we suggest instead is a very cold and scientific analysis, perhaps less attractive initially, but far more likely to achieve success in our goal. And that is, quite simply, that the small minority who own and control those resources have to be dispossessed. They have to have that power stripped from them. And production has to be put in the hands of society as a whole. This has to be done democratically. It can't be done through some kind of minority coup or minority-based violence. It would not work. It simply create a new dictatorship which grew out of that violence. It has therefore to come through a majority participation, through democratic methods, indeed through persuasion, such as we're trying to engage in this evening, open debate, fair discussion, as a result of which a majority develop the ideas and the determination to start to change the system of society that we live under. Of course, the results of capitalism, as long as it lasts, are hideous in the extreme. Because that basic truth at the heart of present-day society, that production is carried out for the cash profit of a minority,
brings with it a whole range of social problems, ranging from the various types of poverty we all experience at different times, on the one hand, to other wider problems of pollution, social alienation, violence, drug dependency, and indeed starvation and war. Starvation because quite clearly people who are dying in their millions have a need for food but do not have the money to back up that need, which is the only kind of need capitalism respects. And war because every war in modern times has arisen directly or indirectly out of the search for profit and the competition for profit between nations in one way or another. Just taking something from tonight's newspaper as a handy and back up to the minute example, it's just been revealed here in this evening's newspaper that a survey today has exposed that in London right now, in some parts of London, there are as many as 296 people applying for every single job vacancy. The figure sounds astounding. That figure of 296 relates specifically to the London Borough of Lewisham. Others are not quite as bad. In the relatively prosperous borough of Westminster in the city, there are just a mere 9 people chasing every one job vacancy. And it ranges then through Ealing, 60 people per vacancy, Islington, 170 people per vacancy, up to Lewisham at 296. The average for the whole of London is 58 people chasing every job vacancy. It's an increase. It was only 11 in 1990. It's now increased to 58. And in the country as a whole, right now, there are 29 people chasing every job vacancy, where there were only 8 in 1990. That perhaps is even more telling than the usual unemployment statistics of 3 or 4 million. It shows the desperate fight, the struggle, the competition by ordinary workers such as ourselves to search for what? What are those hundreds of people, in every case, fighting over and competing over? Not the chance to actually enjoy the world and its riches firsthand. Not the chance to be allowed freely in cooperation with our neighbours to create wealth in a spontaneous and positive way. But instead, the opportunity, if we beg for it, to be allowed access to the earth and its reproductive resources. Those hundreds of people in each job, chasing each job, are saying to the employers, we beg you to allow us into the factories, into the mines, into the hospitals, into the schools, in order that we can work and create wealth. And the employing class, the industrialists, the investors, not through some kind of innate wickedness, not through some sort of evil, but because they have no other choice within this social framework, are having to say, even if they don't like it, they are having to say, no, we cannot employ you because the social system we all live under today dictates at its very heart that there can be no production unless it will prove to be profitable. That is the very nature of the system we live within. And no individual capitalist, any more than an individual worker, has the possibility of changing that effect. It can only be changed by mass social action, organised democratically and politically by the working class as a whole, to transform society from its very roots. Now, towards the end of last year, the popular singer Sinead O'Connor hit the headlines, not with a new album release, but with an odd proclamation, certainly odd amongst popular singers, that money must go, that the entire money system must at all costs be abolished. And she didn't just say this as a throwaway line in between singing about love, the way most singers do. She in fact said it repeatedly, to the great irritation of many of her interviewers. It came out particularly in the interview with New Musical Express, in which no fewer than 15 times in one interview, she said, we must abolish the money system. She simply wouldn't stop repeating the point. Now, whilst as socialists, we will in fact wish to question some of the religious commentaries which were woven in with this, and we might want to question various other things that she said, it was nevertheless very heartening for us to see this proposal of abolishing the money system receiving such an unexpected platform. So let me read, if you'll bear with me, a paragraph or so of the things that she actually said in that interview, just to, so that we can assess to what extent that she was seeing eye to eye with us in the socialist movement, in fact. She said, the only solution, I'm quoting now, the only solution to all of the problems in the world, starvation, homelessness, joblessness, etc., is to get rid of money. A survey has to be conducted. Let's have a vote and see. And the question for the vote is, if everyone else was going to do it, would you be prepared to live without money? Let's see how people feel about that. Supposedly, we live in a democracy. I bet you that people will be able to do it. As long as there exists the system of money, there will always be people who have some and those who haven't. 95% of the world's wealth is owned by 5% of the world's population. That's the whole problem. We can do it, but there's no point unless everyone's going to do it. It just can't work. Look at our lives. Look how they're run by money. Get rid of money. In one foul swoop, you get rid of the whole thing. With love and our supposed belief in God, have the faith to go through the rocky part and believe that God's going to help us out. I told you there was a somewhat religious gloss on it, but that was really only an afterthought in all of the points that she was making. Now, the opposition to her pronouncements about this need to get rid of the money system had a tiresomely familiar ring to it for us socialists. We'd heard these oppositions before when we put the idea ourselves, of course. In supposedly radical journals like New Musical Express and would-be liberal organs like The Guardian, the tired old arguments in defence of this money system were trotted out with religious devotion, as if they had been kept permanently ready just in case there were the first signs of any heretical statement against the money god, and these arguments could then be trotted out and brought out from under their wraps. And here they were. The NME said, for example, on the 14th of November 92, take away money, then you take away the pillars of society. Money may well be the root of all evil, but what choice do we have? Right now, no money equals no power. No power equals a voice in the wilderness. Sad, but that's the real world. That phrase, that's the real world, is something we're used to hearing from the Tories, not so much from the NME, given the kind of subjects they normally have to write about. Most of the records they review are anything but the real world. But that's what they said. Again, NME on the 31st of October. They said, and this was actually a sort of footnote to the interview with Sinead O'Connor, which they had a bit of a dig at her, and they said, Sinead, you don't accept that human nature is essentially competitive and that money is just part of this. But what about you, Sinead? You must have a few quid stacked away somewhere. Really, when somebody tries to deal with a very comprehensive philosophical argument by sort of insisting on inspecting the bank account of the person who happened to have put that argument, it shows they're not really thinking very deeply about the issue. And then The Guardian, even The Guardian, couldn't resist getting the knives out and sticking it into this heretic who dared to say, let's abolish money, 15 times. In a somewhat satirical piece, The Guardian had a subtitle which said, Mad Woman in the Attic, Part 2. I'm not a raving loony, Sinead O'Connor told The Sun last week. My biggest aim is to get rid of money, she continued. If everyone agreed to do it at the same time, it could happen. The Guardian comments wryly, unsold piles of the last Sinead CD could be the new currency. And that's all they have to say about the matter. Now, as I say, there are certain things that Sinead O'Connor said which we may want to query, which I don't think I'll even deal with now, because if anyone's interested, that's something I can come back to later. She's not the only writer who's reached the conclusion, as did the Socialist Party long ago, that money is part of a system which simply must be abolished if we're going to make any further human progress. Let me take, for example, and it's just one example, I'm sure there are others, D.H. Lawrence, who again became somewhat reviled as a heretic, I suspect largely for this reason, amongst others. Indeed, for many years, the Communist Party and others tried to label D.H. Lawrence, the British novelist and poet, as a fascist, and the term fascist was constantly thrown at him. Well, it's true that he had a few other odd ideas, which again, we wouldn't necessarily wish to endorse. But one might suspect that the reason for their hatred for him was, again, not unrelated to his curious ability to come out and make the key point which they had turned their back on for so many years, that the money system is really what must go. And he wrote a collection of poems which is not that well known, certainly not as well known as his famous novels like Lady Chatterley's Lover, which was the subject of a court case for other reasons. But his collection of poems, I would say that probably more than half of them, again, were saying we must abolish money, or related themes, related points. And if there's time now, I'd like to read one or two of these to you. One poem that D.H. Lawrence wrote, Money Madness. Money is our madness, our vast collective madness. And of course, if the multitude is mad, the individual carries his own grain of insanity around with him. I doubt if any man living hands out a pound note without a pang, and a real tremor if he hands out a £10 note. We quail, money makes us quail. It has got us down. We grovel before it in strange terror. And no wonder, for money has a fearful, cruel power among them. But it's not money we're terrified of. It's the collective money madness of mankind. For mankind says, with one voice, how much is he worth? Has he no money? Then let him eat dirt and go cold. And if I have no money, they will give me a little bread so I do not die. But they will make me eat dirt with it. I should have to eat dirt if I have no money. It's that I'm frightened of, and that fear can become a delirium. It's fear of my money-mad fellow men. We must have some money to save us from eating dirt. And this is all wrong. Bread should be free, shelter should be free, fire should be free to all and anybody all over the world. We must regain our sanity about money before we start killing one another about it. It's one thing or the other. Another poem by D.H. Lawrence, again, very little publicised, you might notice, was called Kill Money. And it goes like this. Kill money. Put money out of existence. It is a perverted instinct, a hidden thought which rots the brain, the blood, the bones, the stones, the soul. Make up your mind about it that society must establish itself upon a different principle from the one we've got now. We must have the courage of mutual trust. We must have the modesty of simple living. And the individual must have his house, food and fire all free like a bird. There are many more, actually, which I'd love to read, but obviously I think two is enough just for now. When I was getting these ready for you, I noticed just in passing as a topical point that he came from Nottingham area. And he wrote a poem here as well, probably even more obscure than the last two, about Nottingham University and the fact that it was apparently financed by a foundation from Sir Jesse Boot, who was one of the founders of the Boots chemist chain. And of course, this is on a very topical ring because in the present climate, there's a lot of this sort of private sponsorship of education going on, and particularly now. In fact, it's incredible to think that only 2 weeks ago, the press reported that there is going to be a school in London in the very near future called the Burger King School, the BK School. And children going to that school, it's an ordinary school, local neighbourhood school, they're going to have their school sweatshirts with BK written on it. But this is not quite as new as I thought, because he wrote this poem nearly half a century ago, if not more, in which Nottingham, that dismal town where I went to school and college, they've built a new university for a new dispensation of knowledge. Built it most grand and cakily out of the noble loot derived from shrewd cash chemistry by good Sir Jesse Boot. Little I thought when I was a lad and turned my modest penny over on Boot's cash chemist's counter that Jesse, by turning many millions of similar honest pence over, would make a pile that would rise at last and blossom out in grand and cakey style into a university where smart men would dispense doses of smart cash chemistry in language of common sense. That future Nottingham lads would be cash chemically BSc. That Nottingham lights would rise and say, by Boots I am MA. From this I learned, though I knew it before, that culture has her roots in the deep dung of cash, and folklore is a last offshoot of Boots. And that's it, I think it's excellent as well. It even rhymes in the altitude. So there's D.H. Lawrence, half a century before Sinead O'Connor, also pretty clear that there's something wrong with the existence of money. And indeed, not just leaving it at that, but saying very passionately, put money out of existence. Now, finally, of course, let me come on to what socialists are urging people to do. I would say, in a sense, we take it even one step further. Like Sinead O'Connor, we're saying that money is the root of all evil, to use a time-honoured phrase. Like D.H. Lawrence, we're saying, kill money, put it out of existence. We're going further insofar as that we realise that you cannot abolish money in isolation. It'd be quite impractical and idealistic indeed to simply sit here tonight and say, that's it, just get rid of money and that's that. Of course, what you've got to comprehend is that money is one part of a very complex system. What we're actually saying then is that we must get rid of the system, the social system, of which money is a part. And in doing so, obviously, money goes, just as national boundaries must go, just as banks and prisons and courtrooms and armies are also part of that system, and just as poverty and pollution and war and famine are also part of that system. What is actually at the root of the system is not simply money. We can go even deeper than that. What is actually at the root of the money system is, in fact, private property. The ownership of the earth's resources by a very small minority. And of course, there was that so-called social experiment, which dominated a large part of the 20th century, in which, on the left, particularly in Russia and elsewhere, of course, the state took over ownership and control of social resources. That is emphatically not what socialists advocate, or indeed what genuine socialists ever have advocated. What we have been clear about for a very good long time is that neither private ownership of productive resources nor their ownership by a state bureaucracy is anything like an answer. What we must have instead in getting rid of money is a society across the world in which the community itself, not some kind of elevated bureaucracy, not a political party, not a state or a government, but the community itself, organised locally, organised democratically, actually comes to control resources, both local and global. That's what socialism has as its starting point. What socialism means is the production of wealth will be carried out by society, not in order to make a cash profit for a minority, but instead to satisfy human needs, pure and simple. Production for use, production according to need, not production for profit, not production in order for wealth to be bought and sold. In a socialist society, there will be no buying and selling, because of course there will be no owners and non-owners between whom such transactions can take place. In other words, what world socialism will mean is the end of the concept of individual ownership and group ownership. Instead, all of the productive resources of the world will be owned and controlled in common by the whole of the world's population, and they would be administered democratically by whatever means is decided, both locally, by the people involved at the time. They would have to make decisions, sometimes difficult and complex decisions, about how to administer their wealth, their society, their production. Now, of course, that, put as a serious political alternative, is going very much a stage further. The Socialist Party has been organised for some time precisely for that aim. We urge people like Sinead O'Connor, and have done for that matter, to become involved in that movement, to join us and become part of a proper, organised movement, rather than just being voices in the wilderness. Now, faced with that job of recreating society on the basis of socialist production, as I've touched on it just now, is, of course, a large task. It's not a small task. It's something which involves a persuasive process to challenge the ingrained ideas of millions of conditioned human beings. And therefore, it is a big task, and we'd be foolish to think otherwise. But every social process has its beginning as well as its end. And we would contend that it's already started some time ago. And we're now already in the stage where, if you like, there is a transition process going on right now. Because people are considering alternatives. They are questioning the system which exists. And I would say that the problems faced by socialism, and as I say, there are difficult decisions. There will be complex debates and discussions about how to produce things, what to produce, how to distribute things. But on the basis of common ownership, how much better a starting point it would be for those social discussions than instead having as our starting point private ownership, in which we take the entire earth and its resources, and we say, right, we'll hand it to you, we'll hand it to 1% of the population to own and to control and to dominate, and then the rest of us will sit here and have pointless arguments about what you should be doing with it. Because that's what tonight was about as far as the budget was concerned, if I may end on the point on which I started. Tonight with the budget, what is happening is that people are getting involved in debates, in a sense about something which doesn't concern them. People are getting very hot under the collar about what our Chancellor should do with our taxes and our nation and our wealth. And none of it is ours. Not at the moment. It actually belongs to a very small minority, and all of the statistics bear this out amply. It belongs to a tiny minority. The vast majority of wealth belongs to a tiny minority. And the rest of us are being very foolish indeed when we sit around and debate politics with one another, when in fact we don't even have the very first starting point of owning and controlling the world which we're discussing. So our message to you, the socialists tonight, is to simply consider that as a prospect, as a proposal. When you hear the likes of D.H. Lawrence or Sinead O'Connor talking about abolishing money, let us not join in the cries of heretic, the finger-pointing that took place when we hear these things. Instead, let's say, yes, we get rid of money, but let's have a practical proposition for doing that politically and democratically, getting rid of the entire system of which money is just one rather sordid part.